Okay, Al, we're back talking in a second part of a discussion about contributions you've made to social work practice and some of your life. And I think we ended somewhere around the time you were in the master's program but of social work, but you said you had a few things you wanted to say.
Well, coming out of the Army, I was delayed in starting a career and getting married and raising a family and so on and so forth. So my first endeavor was to select a profession. And after reviewing what was available in terms of possible for me, I decided on social work. The idea of working with people, helping with people with social problems, was consonant with, in line with my background in terms of my family history, in terms of my student history, in terms of my work in the post office and work and my Army experience. All of those made it easy for me to feel comfortable with the social work as a choice. And so I entered the program and with the anticipation that the program would provide me with the technology that enabled me to effectively help people with the social problems they presented. I was somewhat disappointed in what the program had to offer. Right. In terms of training for effectiveness. And then I worked for 2 years subsequent to achieving the master's degree, and that experience further confirmed in my mind the fact that I wasn't adequately prepared for the job.
What kind of job was it, Al?
I worked for a child guidance agency as a child guidance psychotherapist, and I never felt comfortable that I was doing an effective job. I didn't have a conviction in mm-hmm. what I was doing, and it could be that my feeling was partly my own deficiency as a clinician, but naturally you dismiss that as the alternative
right.
and point to the training program as being the culprit. Well, with that in mind, I was looking for a change within the profession. There's a possibility within every profession to move toward things that are quite different in their responsibility. And in line with my previous interest in teaching and my conviction that what social work needed was a more effective technology, I thought that I would devote the rest of my life to an attempt to provide an additional, to increase the effectiveness of the training of the profession.
So when did this happen? Now that seems like a big leap, kind of, to you know, was there a moment when you thought, this is what I have to do?
No. It develops gradually. The first thing is that you don't feel prepared. The blame is with the program. It leads to very clearly devoting yourself to making the program effective, because I had a belief in the desirability of the program. I had no question about that. I thought this was a very desirable endeavor, but one which in some measure was failing in what it attempted to do. And in my previous predilection, so to speak, for teaching, which had been constant throughout, the two things went together. Seeing retreating to the classroom, which is my natural habitat, was a very easy transition. And it resolved the problem for me. I was doing something that was aligned with my acceptance of social work as a desirable profession, and at the same time, devoting myself to academic pursuits, which is involved in research and teaching.
And so this led you to Columbia, to the PhD program in Columbia?
No, I had throughout that I'm talking about over this period, I had been enrolled in the NYU program.
NYU program,
yes.
Right.
And I continued in the program, taking courses, a limited number of courses, while I worked at the Jewish Board of Guardians as a psychotherapist, and looking to see if there are any openings in schools of social work faculty. So I read innumerable bulletin boards, and I sent out applications, and I sent one to Wisconsin. I saw an ad that they were looking for faculty in Milwaukee at the branch of the School of Social Work here. And so I wrote and sent my vita, and I, with great glee, received the response from Martha Miles, who was the dean at the time, indicating an interest in having me come to Wisconsin for an appointment and so on and so forth, which I did, and it was successful, and they hired me.
So how long into the PhD program were you when you got hired at?
I was about the equivalent of three quarters of a year into the program.
So you were pretty new into the program when you got...
Yeah, but pretty confirmed in the program. See, at NYU, in the PhD program, you take a test to begin with, which admits you as a doctoral candidate.
Okay.
So I was a doctoral candidate accepted in the program, and there was no question that if I continued with taking courses, I would ultimately achieve the PhD. That was one of the things that Arthur Miles was very much interested in. He was interested in a social worker who had a leg up for a PhD because these were rare birds to a certain extent. It put me in a very good competitive position, and I just continued in the program. The other thing about the NYU program, which was very desirable, it didn't require any residency, you know, as many PhD programs do. I used to leave Wisconsin at the last session, go to New York, take a pre-summer session courses, then summer session courses, then post-summer session courses. So I was able to get in a lot of coursework every summer, and I think it took me two or three summers to complete all of the coursework that was required for the degree.
Now let me ask you about in your PhD program, what interests developed in this? How did you develop an interest in the kinds of subjects that you were going to eventually pursue?
Yeah, the PhD program, they didn't have a social work PhD program, but they had a counseling program, psychological counseling program in the School of Education.
Okay.
So I took my degree was in educational sociology, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
And my PhD thesis was also in terms of my interest in social work education. The PhD thesis at that time, I was teaching then in Wisconsin because I did the thesis over a period of 3 or 4 years.
Right.
I didn't receive the degree until I had been here close to 5 years. And the thesis project, subject, was in a question of social work education. In teaching social work, I was cognizant of the fact that students didn't have too much of an opportunity of viewing the interview, social work interview, in vivo, so to speak. They had some of that in the fieldwork training, mm-hmm. but that was limited. And so I developed a thesis around the fact that, is it possible for students to sit in on interviews, view interviews that were conducted by social workers in actual performance of the job? That was my thesis. It was, to what extent was this possible? Was this deleterious to the clinician's responsibility to the client? Or could this be a teaching tool? And so I sat in on a lot, I forget the exact number, in two agencies, in a family service agency and the public welfare agencies. I would sit in on the interview with the permission of the client and the worker. I would sit unobtrusively in the back and to the left. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the interview, when the client and worker had finished the interview, I interviewed both the client and the worker as to what they perceived as the intrusion of the observer. So it was really a thesis related to social work education.
So you were really trying to understand if having somebody else in that relationship, in the interview relationship, either took away from the relationship or maybe even added something to the relationship.
Was it possible to have students sit in?
Had students been sitting in before then? I mean, was it common to have students
sit? No, this was entirely new.
Oh, okay, because now it's fairly common when I think of it now.
Yes, no, that was before videotaping and so on. It was even before audio taping. Right. So the students had no access to an actual live interview between a real live social worker and a real live client, which made it very interesting.
Right, so that was really, you know, because when you said it, you know, even on my own career going back 40 years, that was fairly common that you could sit in on. But when you, this was actually quite new.
Yeah, but that was the question that was raised. Is it a damaging to the relationship and to the needs of the client by having the intrusion of the student? And the fact that it proved not being very damaging, most of the time, as a matter of fact, after the first 3 or 4 minutes, the client was not aware of the fact that I was sitting in. There were only occasions if a woman client and she began to discuss something with reference to a pregnancy. At that point, because I was male and had been introduced, she became aware because she wondered whether this was appropriate to say in my male hearing. So there were occasions like that, but relatively rare. Sometimes if a man was the client, they would turn to me if they were talking about something that was male related. Mm-hmm. But that didn't happen very often.
So in some ways, this was really the beginning of an interest, which one of your focal points throughout your scholarship in terms of interviewing. And I think at the beginning of our, when I introduced us at the first session, I mentioned that you're working now on the fifth edition of your book called The Social Work Interview, which has been published by Columbia University Press, which is why I got Columbia mixed up with NYU in the early things. So that was really, from your dissertation arose that interest.
Yeah, but all along, the interview is the ubiquitous activity of the worker. The only thing he's doing is interviewing, as a matter of fact. So even before that, and that led me to the thesis, I was interested in the interview because I was teaching part of that in the classes. When I did the thesis, I had been teaching at Wisconsin for maybe 2 or 3 years, you know. And then during the time that I was doing the thesis was another 2 or 3 years.
So let's talk a little bit about the early times of teaching in Wisconsin. What was the department like at that time? I think it had just become its own school of social work a couple of years before that. Isn't that the case?
Yeah, 1946.
Right.
It became an independent school, and they hired Art Miles, who had administrative experience in public welfare, had a PhD from the Chicago, I forget the exact name of the Chicago school, but he was a graduate of the Chicago school, had a PhD from there, yeah.
Who else were the early faculty that you remember that when you were hired?
Early faculty, Helen Clark was a member of the faculty.
She was really the first faculty person at the school, is that right?
She preceded, as a matter of fact.
Right. Trying to remember some names. I don't know if they were around then. Virginia Franks? Was she Virginia Franks?
Virginia Franks wasn't a member of the faculty at that point. She was a field work supervisor.
We'll come back to it. Tell me a little bit about what was the campus like when you came?
The campus, that was at the height of the GI Bill. And so the campus, there were concert huts right in the middle of the campus. The campus was very crowded. The campus was heavily older students because most of the GIs who came back were somewhat advanced, older than most of the general student body. Heavily male, experienced, people who had been out in the world with little patience for, abstruse argumentation, so on and so forth. And it was very, very lively. People lived, they had to live away from the campus, there was a community.
Eagle Heights, I think. I don't know if that was even around then, the community that's there now.
That's right.
Yep.
Yeah. And for the faculty, it was a different world, too. Housing was very in short supply then. There had been no housing built during the war. And so in order to attract faculty, they had to make housing available. And so they built university houses.
Oh, okay.
That was the reason they built it.
That was the evolution of that. Okay.
And all of the new faculty, most of the new faculty, lived at university houses. There were some people who lived elsewhere. But the whole university houses was filled of recent acquirers to the university. And it was like a commune.
Mm-hmm.
See, all of them were new. All of them were worried about tenure. All of them had young children. And we lived cheek by jowl, because we were very closely grouped. The houses weren't separate. There were units that were separate, but everybody lived just near anybody. So the social life of the faculty was with university housing people rather than their own faculty.
Okay.
See, I socialized mostly with people who were not in the social work faculty, but rather who lived alongside of me in the social work in the university houses.
Now, at this time, you were married now?
And yes, I was married.
You were married to your wife, Sylvia.
I had, we had two, when we came here, we had one child, Goldie, and Rafe was born here at the University Hospital.
Okay, so so it was really a big bunch of transition times for you. What was it like coming from New York to the Midwest?
Well, you know, when I told my mother particularly, I said, I'm going to Wisconsin, my mother thought, that's Indian territory. Where are you going? But there's certain drama associated with this. This is more family.
Right.
Sylvia was at one that time 9 months pregnant. I mean, 7 months pregnant. Sylvia was, both of us were somewhat older. Sylvia was 35 years old. And this was the first time that she was pregnant. She was comfortable with her obstetrician. She was comfortable with the friends that she knew.
In New York,
yeah,
right.
New York. She had family in New York. And I tell her, listen, Sylvia, we're going to some strange state. We don't know where we'll be housed because we didn't have housing then when we came to Milwaukee. And God bless her, Sylvia said, go. Mm-hmm. You know?
Now, what's interesting there, in terms of different times, today's day, probably what would have happened if the wife might have stayed where she was for a year or so.
Yes.
And the husband, in those days, that was not...
No. Well, Sylvia didn't want that, and I didn't want that. But it took a tremendous amount, I thought, a tremendous amount of courage on her part to leave a comfortable, familiar setting with a doctor that she's had 7 months contact with, go off someplace, get into a new doctor, get into a new house. And we lived, as a matter of fact, in a hotel for the first, until a little after Goldie was born. We didn't have housing in Milwaukee. It was very, difficult living.
I have to remember, we're in Milwaukee now, right?
Yes.
Because the University of Wisconsin at Madison and Milwaukee were the same school of social work
That's
at that
right.
time. Is that right?
Okay. We were a branch,
Of
the School of Social
Work.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we were in the Brumda building on Wisconsin Avenue.
I'm thinking about something that happens now. When a new faculty comes to campus now, they're usually assigned a mentor. Somebody, another faculty person who, you know, is to help guide them in the tenure process and guide them over time and support them. Was that the case in your day?
No. Well, I went to Milwaukee well, I had to come to Madison to be interviewed by the Madison faculty and by Art Miles, and they introduced you at that time to the president of the university, and I met with him. And we spent, a couple of days here getting acquainted. But then I went back to Milwaukee, which had their own administrative staff.
Right.
And the administrative staff in Milwaukee said, what do you want to teach? Go teach it. Here's your office.
So you were kind of like, just take care of yourself.
Yes, take care of yourself.
What did you teach at the beginning?
I taught casework and human development, HUBSE.
Human behavior in a social environment.
Human behavior in a human environment,
okay.
Yes.
Okay.
I taught that, apparently I taught it reasonably successfully. Nobody complained to the dean of the school that I was...
What was a class like? Did it have 5 students? Did it have 100 students?
No. We had students about, most classes were 12 to 15 students. And most of them, in Milwaukee, the largest percentage of them were women. I taught one course in Madison. I would come one day from Milwaukee to Madison, and I taught here. Here we had more men students in the class, and they were more difficult to deal with. I was teaching with you, Hubsy, psychoanalytic ideology, id, ego, superego, conscious, preconscious, mm-hmm. unconscious. They didn't want to hear it. They didn't buy that easily. I got a lot of questions. They were very lively, a very obstreperous group.
Was that partially because you said they were older, had come back to school, you think? And
I'm sorry.
Was that related to the fact that these were older students who had maybe been in the war? And what did they want to know?
First of all, they wanted to know, are there jobs available? And then there were jobs available, a lot of jobs available. And what did they know in order to do the job? They wanted to know how to do it. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to know about theory. They didn't want to know about, other interesting ideas that were the basis for the technology of what they're doing. They wanted to know how to do it.
Yeah. And in some ways, this continues on to today to a degree, but maybe it was a little more pronounced.
Yeah, they were in a hurry. See, they were like me. They were delayed in getting a profession, and they were delayed in getting their family started or even supporting their family, and they were anxious to get out and get a dollar, mm-hmm. get a salary.
We were just talking about what students some of the students were like, just tell me what I need to know to get my job.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's pretty much it.
And I could, appreciated their point of view. To some extent, I was allied with them, you know. And that made my teaching easier because I was a veteran and they were veterans and we had been involved in something together so that while they were opposed to some of the things I was saying, they weren't in nature negative in their relationship with me.
So at this time now, these are your early years at school, you're teaching, you're working on your dissertation.
That's right.
And you're going back
in the summer.
To the summer for school. So you were a busy,
yes.
One busy person.
Yes.
And were you also trying to write at the time, or?
No, I was trying to write the thesis.
Right.
After I wrote the thesis, I got two or three publications from the thesis. But at that time, I wanted to get the thesis done and, the PhD. I needed the credential.
Right. How long did you stay at Milwaukee before you moved on to Madison? So what precipitated that move?
What precipitated the move was there's somebody here on the staff who left, and there was an opening. Okay? And all along, I had made hints that if there was an opening, I would like to be considered for it.
Now, why? Why would you want to be?
Madison was a more desirable. Milwaukee was like, an offshoot. We didn't have anything. We didn't have a campus. We were in an office building.
Oh, okay.
We had two stories.
So this was before the whole UW-Milwaukee campus.
Oh, yeah. Okay. There was no Milwaukee campus. It was the Teachers College, which had nothing to do with the University of Wisconsin.
Okay.
No, we were off on our own, And Madison, of course, always had the reputation of being one of the best cities. You know that article in Life.
Right. Right. I remember the picture on the front page.
The famous article in Life. So who could, So we, I know he's made the noises if there's an opening, you know, consider me. And apparently I would felt they regarded me as sufficiently competent to invite me to join the staff here.
And so when you came here, did you teach some of the same topics?
Yes.
Or
did,
okay, see.
I taught casework and I taught Hubsy, yeah.
And the students, you said, were a little more, were a little different here,
yeah.
more male kinds of
yeah.
things and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Was the school at that time, the Department of Social Work, the School of Social Work, were you connected to the community? Was there a connection between the agencies and the school?
Oh,
was
yes.
Was it a close relationship?
Yes. Closer than subsequently, as a matter of fact. See, at that time, the faculty was required to visit X number of agencies. We divided all of the fieldwork agencies, and each faculty member had three or four agencies that they were obligated to visit twice a semester, at midterm and at the end of the semester, to read records of students, you know, select a number of records, and to discuss with the supervisor, student supervisor, the student performance, but also to discuss with the supervisor what they were teaching that aligned with what we were teaching at the school. So there was a very close connection. Every semester we were out in the community at least twice a year for a limited number of agencies. So we had a very decent direct hands-on knowledge of what was going on in the social work community.
So you were like the liaison between
That's
the schools.
Right.
So there were students, there might be six students at this agency, three at another.
That's right.
And then your responsibility, similar to I think much of what it is today, your responsibility was to see how they were doing in the agency, make sure they were getting what they needed.
Yeah. But also to read records.
Actual read records, so you would read case records.
Yeah, case records.
Right.
Yeah, select a number of case records to get some idea, in addition from what the student supervisor was saying, from the actual student's performance.
Yeah. And did those relationships and agencies eventually spur any research relationships, or was being connected in that way, shape, or form helpful to faculty who were doing work in social work practice? In other words, if they wanted to do studies in agencies and things, did that facilitate that, or was it just not?
Yeah, to some extent that was true. It did for me because I had a connection with the child welfare agencies, and that ultimately led to some research in the child welfare agencies. I knew the personnel, I knew some of the problems that could be researched, and so on and so forth. I can't answer for other faculty.
Right. But that leads me to talking about child welfare a little. One, you know, I think your substantive knowledge base has always been the child field of child welfare.
That's right.
And how did you get attracted to that? What was important? Like, why that particular field, other than aging or other than any of the just criminal justice? Why child welfare?
Well, if you're teaching Hubsy, you know, you're teaching a good deal of child development. And if you're teaching a good deal of child development, you're dealing with a good deal of the kinds of problems that are likely to result from disordered families and so on and so forth. So all along in teaching Hubsy, I was also teaching, to some extent, child welfare. It was an easy transition to make. I might say I did one summer have an appointment, I forget what it was called, the aging unit in Washington.
Mm-hmm. Let me National Institute of Aging or something like that.
Let me erase that whole thing.
Okay, erase.
Because it's a diversion.
Okay.
And so on and so forth. But let me go back to child welfare.
Yeah.
It was an easy transition from, as I said, from teaching Hubsley into concern with child welfare. And in casework, too, in teaching casework, a good deal of the cases that we handle, a good deal of the cases that we discuss, were child welfare cases, you know.
Well, it also occurs to me that, you know, you've always been involved with the core parts of social work practice, the interview, core part. And in probably no field is more core or historically been core to social work than child welfare services.
You're right.
So did this fit in part of that whole sense of wanting to contribute to what is it the social workers really do?
That's right. Okay. That's right. It was a nice package that I had no question about pursuing, you know.
And how, when did you start writing about child welfare?
I really don't remember. It's a long time. I think the first book, first edition of the child welfare book was in 50-something, very early in the game.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the interest in child welfare, like you not only got interested in a piece of child welfare, you got interested in the whole of the child welfare system, it seems to me.
Well, if you're going to research, I got interested in foster care, and I did a piece of research through the state on foster care. They sponsored it partly, the university sponsored it partly. And I wrote a series of articles on the results of my research on foster care. It was a question of movement into foster care and then the return home from foster care. What were the factors that impeded this kind of transition? What were the factors that accelerated this kind of transition? And then I went on to doing research on adoptions. At that time, social workers were very reluctant to place older children, which is defined as a five-year-old child, for adoption, because the supposition was that he came from a dysfunctional family. And if he had lived 5 years in a dysfunctional family, he's likely not to be able to make an adequate adjustment to adoption. And so I did a research. I interviewed children, families who had adopted children of 5 years of age or older to determine what had happened subsequent to their adoption. This was 3 or 4 years after their adoption. To what extent had they made an adequate adjustment? To what extent was the adjustment difficult? What ways was the adjustment difficult? And so on and so forth. And it turned out that the largest percentage of them, there were some adoption failures, the largest percentage of them was successful. And the message to the field was that you have these children who need adoption. It's unethical not to consider them, when the research shows to some extent that this might have an opportunity of making a successful adoption. So I did that piece of research.
Okay. So you got into foster care, you got into adoption, and then from there you...
And then I did a piece on child abuse. The piece on child abuse was concerned with physical abuse. And the problem was, what actually precipitated the abusive incident? See, every abusive incident is almost accidental. It's not thought out in advance. Nobody says, I am going to physically abuse this child. A series of interactions develop, and at some point, the parent flashes out. And we were interested in determining what happened in that interaction so as to alert the social worker how he could work with the client and prepare the client for the fact that this might happen, and this might, you might gonna do this, and you might do this. Watch yourself, see? So we went back to interview women and men, but mostly women, who had abused, physically abused their children. We did what was called retrospective introspection. We said, go back to the time when this incident occurred. What was the first thing that happened? The woman said, the kid was doing this, so I said to the kid, don't do this, don't do this. Then the kid continued to do this, stopped for a while, and then went back to doing this. And then I said, you continue to do this, I'll take away your bicycle. And the kid continued, said, go to your room. Went to the room, and he banged on the door, and they had to get out of the room. And at some point, got to the point, they lashed out. So we went through this whole sequence of events to determine at what point it erupted in abuse, physical abuse. The word I was looking for before was it's episodic, not intermittent. Episodic. It's episodic. Okay. Child abuse is episodic. It happens without much premeditation and so on, not deliberate and so on. So, and we I wrote a book on that. I and Judy Martin,
right,
who was part of the team who interviewed the mother.
So I have to ask you a question because this is a story I remember for many years. So the title of the book, I think, was Child Abuse, an Interactional Event? Now, I recall, I don't know if this is part of the mythology, Al, that you had wanted or thought about calling it the child's contribution to abuse.
Well, I thought about that for a very short period
because,
of time.
Because you really were trying to...
I know. Well, see, what happened was this got out to the press, and the press, not so much here, but in Milwaukee, they wrote a sharp editorial of all the kinds of research we needed. We needed to have a piece of research that contributes, that the child contributes to his own physical abuse. There was a lot of criticism on that.
Right.
Of course, it translates to that. You are saying that this is not only the parent that's involved, it's the child that's involved. And there's this complex interaction. But unless you honestly face that, it's very difficult to go to an abusive parent with the sense that they're to blame. They're not going to listen to you. If you go with some appreciation of what they were facing, you run a better possibility of evoking some response from them. That was our idea.
And so this was one of, I'm sure, many times in a long career that you one encounters a political correctness kind of
thing. Oh, yeah.
Which, and it sounded like this was a pretty pronounced one.
Yeah, in the one about adoption, we had a lot of the people who were certain that whatever the child was the fault of the parent, and by the time the child was 5 years old, he had it, you know? And so now you're saying that, well, people can face this kind of situation and still come out whole. They objected to that.
And at some point, you have five editions, your fifth edition now or sixth edition, of your child welfare book. So you put it all together. So you've had your books and articles on these specifics, and then you put it together. And was it the first, or was it certainly, in my mind, one of the more well-known or most well-known book in child welfare services in social work practice? So when it came out, how was it received when it came out?
Oh, it was received very warmly, as a matter of fact. We got very good reviews, you know, in the book reviews of the thing. It was more comprehensive than the books that had been previously available on child welfare. It was very well documented.
That's what I was going to say. I remember, because we talked earlier about your penchant for, you know, immersing yourself in the literature. And they're extremely well documented, as I recall.
And see, this is an online. See, there are two ways you can help to develop the technology of the profession. One is through research, in which you add new knowledge. But the other way is to organize the knowledge that is available. See, every piece of research is a little bit, like a little, you know, a grain of sand. That's not useful to the worker. Somebody has to take these grains of sand and put it together in some comprehensible, understandable way, so that they can then read it and use it, and it helps them become more effective in their work. So the research goes along with the textbook writing. That's what I always thought of myself, in that the textbook writing is organizing the knowledge of the field in a way that makes it useful for transmission to the worker, enabling him, as he reads this, makes use of it to do a better job.
And in some ways, that theme of your synthesizing the research,
that's right,
really goes through some of your major books, the interview book, child welfare, supervision.
Supervision, too.
Consultation.
Yes.
So some of the core parts of social work practice, one of your major contributions is bringing disparate, and not just social work research, I think it's important to say. In other words, you brought research from all the...
No, wherever the research was relevant. And see, that was another thing. A lot of the social work literature hadn't made an effort to exploit what was available elsewhere. And this was more of available. This could contribute to the knowledge that is useful in effective performance.
Let me ask you about your work style. I'm trying to think how to, you know, each of those fields, interviewing is a huge, child welfare is huge. How did you get from the actual process? How do you distill that information? What was it like to write the book?
I'll tell you what I'm doing. It just is today. I'm doing this with Goldie, we're going through the internet for anything, we go keywords and take out anything that has relevant to the content of the book. We have to be somewhat selective because otherwise you're drowning. Now, today, just this morning, I was at the School of Social Work at 7:30. I'll tell you what I was doing. On Friday at 4:30, in line with my discussion with Jane, I picked up three copies of the Social Work Abstract, 1999, 2001. The last book was published in 1997, so we're trying to get things from 1999. I went home over the weekend and went through the index of each one of these volumes to see any article that might be relevant and make out a card. I'll go back Friday, pick up 203, 204. Very detailed, any reference that might have, then you get the article. Then you read the article, and you read five articles, you got one paragraph or one idea or one fact and so on and so forth.
And what you know, you mentioned the internet, but I want to say to people, I know that you don't use a computer, so you do all this by hand, or much of it by hand. And certainly you did much of it by hand when everybody was doing
it. Yeah, before I used to do it by hand.
Right, right.
Yeah, and now I can.
But how do you organize it all? In other words,
well, we also hired a woman who is computer expert, and she's going through all of psych abstracts, and then she's going through medical abstracts, you know, and we give her the keywords, and she's then, and Goldie is also, who is an expert with the computer, going through the material.
So I think what I'm trying to get at, and you know, because I know you a little, is your style of, you know, of actual, so we know you gather that information, but I know in your house you have a basement library.
Yeah.
And I picture you down there, I'm not seeing this, yeah, early in the morning, hovered over.
Yes.
Is that the kind of style, or is that what you
yes.
do?
Yeah. My home is comfortable, it's nice, it's private. You work on it. Sylvia's upstairs. If she wants me, I'm right below Sylvia.
She stomps on the floor, okay.
I come up, what do you want? Or I take a break, I come up. And so it's very comfortable, it's very easy. There's no, I'm blessed with that.
But that's a style of, you like to really immerse yourself in the books.
That's right. It's like somebody, a archaeologist in the field, he goes out, he digs, he finds something. The same thing, you read an article and you find, oh, gee, that's I never thought of that, you know? Mm-hmm. And you read an article and say, oh, that confirms what this guy is saying, you know? It's a process of discovery, but there's a delight in discovering, see? And you're gathering all of the marbles.
And then you're putting them together, which is so easy.
The writing is hard.
Right.
The writing is hard at the beginning when you sit down and start to write. But once it gets rolling, it becomes a little easier. And I never remember feeling very stressed about that. I was doing what I really enjoyed doing. I felt it was useful. I didn't have any question the fact that, that this was a desirable kind of activity. It was an interesting. It's in line with whatever is temperamentally true for me. The privacy also is, I might say. Hmm. I tend to be a private person, and I need people, but not to the extent that many people do. Writing is a very private endeavor. You know, you're right. Alone with it. And this research is a very private endeavor, going through the literature. But I'm comfortable with that.
And maybe going back to your school, so at some point you go up for tenure, right?
For tenure.
How was the tenure process in those days, and you know?
The tenure process was difficult. They needed people because the university was expanding.
Growing because of that.
Yeah.
Right.
I came up for tenure. I couldn't come up for tenure until I got the PhD. So I came up for tenure in 1955. I was beginning to be considered the tenure. 1955, 5 years after I joined the faculty. It came to the divisional committee. The School of Social Work voted me for tenure unanimously. It came to the divisional committee. I had the PhD, but I had three publications at that point. The divisional committee took a look and said, you know, three publications.
They forgot that you were teaching, going to school, and going back on, but okay.
But the divisional committee
didn't care.
They looked, publication. So they said, this doesn't wash. And on the first go, they said no. So Art Miles went back, asked for another hearing of the committee. He went back to the committee, and I don't know what he said. He must have said something to the effect that he needed this person who has a PhD, most of the rest of the faculty didn't. He needed a male on the faculty, and he had mostly females. Whatever he said, I don't know, but they voted for tenure.
Did you have any resentment about that? Any resentment? When they turned you down initially?
Oh, no.
No?
Disappointment, mm-hmm. Sadness. Mm-hmm. Went to Sylvia, said, comfort me. She took me around and comforted me, but I was still without tenure. Mm-hmm. But all of the people around me were fighting tenure. See, and some of the guys in other disciplines, they had been in their discipline for some time. They had 20 articles, 15 articles, 13 articles. I knew when the tenure committee took a look at my publications, I anticipated that they might have second causes because the guys I were talking to had a different kind of record. There were some like me, you know, who had three, four publications.
Right.
But that was a difficult time.
I'm sure. Yeah. And as you now you get tenure, and the department at some point starts to grow fairly rapidly, I think, in terms of numbers of faculty, grow slowly.
Yeah.
Okay. And you know, what role did you play in the department once you had tenure? What did you look for when you wanted to hire new people? What was going on around this? Now we're in what, the late 50s, early 60s type thing, about.
Huh?
Are we in the late 50s, late 1950s, early 60s?
Yeah, in the 1950s, yeah. For the most part, and this is possible, I worked independently. My contact with the faculty was mostly around committees that we were jointly assigned to. I didn't consult much with the faculty what I was doing, what they were doing, and so on and so forth. I worked mostly pretty much alone. As I said, my social life didn't revolve around my contact with the faculty. So we had, regular occasions where we met as a group. Julie Miles, who was
author's wife.
Yeah. She was wonderful in terms of getting the faculty together for social occasions and so on and so forth. And we did, have contact with them. But on a personal basis, for another thing, a good deal of the faculty was women, And
you didn't like women?
No. I grew. But it's always a question, I don't know how aware I was of that, Sylvia said, who did you have lunch with today? I had lunch with Sally Gaines. had lunch with Bernard Sorchin. Woman, yeah. How'd the lunch go?
Now, about when did your son Raphael was born? He's the youngest child, right?
Yeah.
So he was born after you got tenure.
Who?
Raphael.
Raphael.
Yeah, Raphael. When was he born? Oh. I mean, you know, he was born around what time? After you had
Rafe
10 years?
Rafe was born in, after we came to Madison in 1953.
Oh, so he was, yeah. Okay. So
yeah, he was born here.
So you had, both children were born in a...
In Wisconsin.
In Wisconsin.
Yes.
Okay.
And both children speak with a Wisconsin accent.
Okay. Do you think they agree to that?
Apple.
So now we're in, say, the early, you know, 60s. You know, how did your career evolve from? Okay, you got here. You spent 5 years, yeah, or so. You get tenure. So how do you see your own career evolving?
Well, in 1958, I got a Fulbright.
Okay.
The Fulbright, you know, was one of these honorary appointments. That you went to some foreign school, right, on some assignment. I went to Holland in Groningen. Groningen is a city on the eastern section of Holland, and not too far from the German border. And so I spent a year there teaching at the School of Social Work in Groningen, which was a very interesting and very good assignment. The Netherlands is, of course, a wonderful country in terms of advanced civilization. The school was very warmly welcoming. The students were very good. Most of them spoke English, so that I was able, at that level, anybody who got to the level of the School of Social Work was knowledgeable in English.
Right.
Although they appointed somebody in the class, if my English was not comprehensible, they made the translation into Dutch.
So was this your first international experience?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, after the war,
right, right,
Saipan was international.
Right. That's very true. And did you choose to go to Holland, or is that where the
They had various openings, and I applied for this particular Fulbright, and the dean of the School of Social Work at that time was in America. She came and interviewed me. Okay. Yes. And apparently she liked what she saw. Of course, she sponsored me for the appointment. So we lived in Groningen for the better part of the year. The kids went to the school in Groningen and learned Dutch. And sometimes when I had to go out into the community, I had to learn to turn to Goldie and say, what?
Right, the child was the
which
adult,
is very
right?
demeaning.
Right, right.
Well, you have to look to the child to translate for you. But they made it. Groningen had been liberated by the American forces, unlike some other parts of Holland. And so they had a very warm feeling toward the Americans, you know. When Rafe went to school, they put him up in front to introduce him. So it was a wonderful assignment in a wonderful city. Groningen, mm-hmm, is a small city, typical Dutch city. It was a wonderful year.
Yeah, that sounds like a very exciting time.
Yeah.